The Capital Area Dental Society brings to you The Drill Down. We're your hosts, Dr. Shwetha Ramanathan and
Sarah Carter.
Today's episode is all about money, something every dentist thinks about, but not everyone talks about. Whether you're fresh out of school or already a practice owner, financial planning is the backbone of a sustainable and satisfying career. Joining us today is Davin Bell from North Star, a privately held financial planning firm that's been around since 1908 and specializes in serving doctors. Let's dive right in. Welcome to the podcast, Davin.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. And I haven't been with the firm since 1908.
Yeah.
But the firm's been around since 1908.
Sorry, we forgot to
good clarify. Clarification.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm thrilled to be here. This is awesome.
We're really happy to have you.
Yes.
I want to get started and I want to just ask you about the, you know, when new dentists graduate and they're right out of school and they're overwhelmed by debt. Some people are graduating with like almost $500,000 in debt. That doesn't even include going to residency. So you're out and you're finally getting a paycheck. What do you do with that money? How do you budget that money? What is your advice for someone starting out?
Yeah, great question. You're not wrong. It's the, I don't think you can, you can't understate the emotional toll that that can start to take. I mean, finances just in general is very emotional. Mm-hmm. The stock market's emotional, but when it comes to debt, and now you're getting paid. And most of the advice actually that you see out there, now I say out there, meaning like YouTube or LinkedIn or Instagram, is just get rid of that debt as fast as humanly possible. That tends to resonate because people are like, all right, good. The faster I get rid of the debt, the better I'm going to feel. But the reality is there's also something that most doctors, dentists, doctors of all types have been conditioned to not having cash. So the reality is in your first, call it 6 to 9 months of just launching and now getting a taste of those paychecks, your first priority is actually to build cash because cash is that space that says, all right, I know that I have debt and I'm not saying ignore debt, but if you put an emphasis on building cash, you know, you're not going to add any more new debt. So that's kind of that's the first step. That's the first step. The other thing is because finances are emotional, it's important to have kind of a rules of engagement. Like, all right, how do I set the cadence? I'm getting paid every 2 weeks or sometimes practices only pay monthly. But here's a savings rate that will serve you long into the future. Save 15% of your gross income. That's before taxes. And the old joke is it's gross, what you're going to be paying in taxes. You net, you get to take home what you net. But if you save 15% of your gross income, and if it's a, if there's a we in your equation, if there's a household, 15% of your household gross income. If you do that for 20 years, and in dentistry, it's a physical job. So, I mean, hopefully you can work for 30 or 35 or 40 because you want to. But those first two decades are critical debt elimination and investment build, but save 15% by putting that into cash. That's for you. And it takes the typical dentist and subspecialist, orthodontist, periodontist, about 18 to 24 months to look up and say, okay, I've got about a 6 month emergency reserve just by that cadence of 15% of your gross income, just driving that to cash first. We can get into investments and stuff later on, but go ahead.
And 6 months is what you're recommending, right? Because sometimes we see stats like 3 months for an emergency reserve. What goes into that number?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the 3 months is certainly acceptable. And you're right. Most financial planning books will say, you know, save $1,000 or save 3 months. And by the way, when I say 6 months of your living expenses, so your rent, car payment, student loan payment, gym membership, cell phone, add it all up, whatever it takes to run your household times six. And the reason is there's not a guarantee the practice you join, you're going to fall in love with. Or it might be that I'm launching a practice. I need to have enough cash to have some runway to make sure my life can keep marching forward. The doctors who just that very first paycheck, they pay their bills, drive everything to debt. they have no choice.
Right.
And part of that feeling of financial freedom is I want to at least have a say in the matter. And mm-hmm. if I have cash, I can say, you know what? This practice isn't what I thought it was going to be. I can afford to disengage, still service, and re-engage with a practice. You start with a new practice on Monday, does not necessarily mean you're getting paid next Friday. So you've got to have some runway there. And you start chipping, 3 months is quick. Like you burn through 1 month, you're like, I'm down to 2 months. Now I'm down to one. It goes fast. So that's why I say 6 months
instead of three.
Is a really good marker of financial health.
And where do you put that savings money? Like, are we just putting this at Chase Bank? Should we put it in a high yield savings, which, you know, Davin, full disclosure, Davin's also my financial advisor. So I do know the answer to this.
You know, but it's a good question because it seems minor, but it actually is a big deal. And your checking account / savings, you know, to your point, Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, those should be treated as just operational accounts. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is paychecks in, bills go out. It's a super highway of cash, a wood chipper, stuff's flying around. What you want to then do is attach to that, link to it, something called a high yield savings or a money market account. They are one and of the same. The reason you have a money market account is not for the interest, even though they pay more interest than what your checking account is at Bank of America, Wells, Chase, Citi, et cetera. I think right now they're paying like 3.5%. Mm-hmm. The reason you're moving cash there is for the organization of it. So your peer group, they're almost surgical in how they organize their savings. Mm-hmm. So a typical dentist that I work with across the country will have up to 5 savings accounts, 1 login, 1 password. I'll give some examples. There's Marcus, run by Goldman Sachs. There's Ally. There's Capital One 360.
Y'all are looking to sponsor.
yeah, exactly. Right. So, and I don't work for any of those companies, but they're all good. They all allow you to have multiple accounts. So if someone's logging into their money market, they don't just see a pile of cash. They actually will have it organized. They'll have an emergency reserve, a vacation account, a house account, their next car purchase, really any money you might need in the next 3 years belongs in a cash account. The market's way too volatile. If somebody's like, well, I need to find a money market that pays high interest. If you Google and start looking for, most money markets right now are paying 3.5%, somewhere in that space. If you find one that's paying disproportionately higher than all the other money markets out there, that's actually a sign of distress. Because a bank's oxygen is deposits. Mm-hmm. So if they say, Shweta, I'll give you more than anybody else, just give us your cash. That's a sign of distress. I wouldn't go anywhere near it. Cash allows you then to leave your investments where you're going to make your wealth, where the money's going to really work for you is, you know, when you invest. So mm-hmm. cash is that anchor, but being organized matters. Even for married couples, they each have their own checking account, which is fine. Sometimes they have a joint checking. That's not the path to a happy marriage, but a joint savings account is, where you could be proactively looking at the end of the week, of a busy week with, you know, your practice and then the kids and all the stuff. Great. Well, how are we doing towards our vacation account? How are we doing towards our house account, our next car purchase? Those are rallying cries as opposed to, why did you go to Starbucks? I thought we were going to go on this austerity plan, which doesn't really, that's not fun for the relationship.
No,
but a joint savings matters. Like that's right. Where you're going to win the day. Yeah. Great question.
We also give relationship advice. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. No charge.
Just a little extra.
So now you kind of alluded to that debt before, right? You were like, you know, taken into account all of our monthly expenses. We were kind of multiplying that by 6. That's the number we're looking at. But now I want to really tackle that debt.
Okay.
What you're looking at this amount of money, and it's a big amount of money. And there's so many options. You know, you can refinance, you can do income-driven repayment. How do you decide? I mean, and what do you do?
Right. And we're still learning in terms of the federal, you know, what the new rules are and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'll touch on those. me take a quick step back, because here's something else that this were just will get you in a good emotional headspace. I talked about the 15% savings rate. When it comes to debt, use, because people have all kinds of debt, not just student loan debt. They also have a little bit of credit card debt, maybe some car debt, whatever. Use something called the 8% rule. This is powerful. Any debt that is charging you an interest rate of 8%, 9% and beyond should be dealt with. Like, that does take priority after you've built your cash. So if I have this 15% that I'm saving of my gross, and I'm just brand new practicing, I'm driving that to cash. And then once I have a 6-month reserve, I'm not now taking that 15% and investing it. I'm going to eliminate that high interest debt. I'm going to make it go away. Okay. Most debt that right now, today, that's charging an interest rate of 7% or 6%, maybe even 5%, is scheduled debt. So things like student loans, right? So you have $500,000 of student loans. Some people have $500,000 mortgage, or even a car note. Those are all on a schedule. Car notes are 5 years. Mortgages are 15 or 30. Student loans, if they're federal, are amortized over 10 years, right? There's programs out there that allow you to pay on it longer, but the way that a bank will look at it is you have 10 years to pay this off, a student loan. So once I've eliminated high interest debt, now that 15% of my gross income, that's sacred. That needs to now be set aside for you. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to things like student loan debt or any type of scheduled debt, the worst case scenario is you follow the schedule.
Yeah.
So 5 years from now, your car is paid off. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. We don't like the interest that we're paying, but I bought the car anyway because I didn't have the cash. So, okay, I'm going to pay more than what the sticker price was. That's a little easier to solve. Student loans is a different animal. So big asterisks out there. Everyone seems like there should be like a national program for student loans, but take this and understand your situation might be a little bit different. Each individual's, if someone's living in a household with dual income, et cetera. But generally speaking, directionally, this is how this is going to go. Somebody has $500,000 of student loans and they're all subsidized. Maybe some are unsubsidized, meaning federal loans. They got rid of the SAVE program. That was kind of the big deal. So if someone's just coming out of dental school, like, I never had a chance to choose it. But for the past 5 years, it's been a little wonky. There's been no interest because of 2020. Well, now that music stopped. So now everyone's got to grab a debt elimination chair. Like, how am I going to do this? It's advisable early in your career to do the, either pay as you earn or what's called income-based repayment, IBR. Mm-hmm. The reason, because if I'm just now out working, or I've been out 2 years or 3 years for that matter, they still see your income from 2 or 3 years ago. The system is way behind. The income-based repayment is they will take 10 years to pay off your loan. So if someone has $500,000, they're going to pay $50,000 a year for the next 10 years. Plus interest, but they will not take more than 10% of your income. Okay. So 50,000 is a little over 4,000 a month, plus some interest. But if I'm making 200 grand, they're not going to make me pay more than 20 grand a year because of that income, based repayment. Mm-hmm. So, okay, great. But then all of a sudden next year I make 250. Now I have to pay 25 grand. If I make 300, now I got to pay 30 grand. So if my income is on this rising scale, the income-based repayment will work probably for your first 2 years. Mm-hmm. Every time you file your taxes, they do what's called a recertification. So at that point, it can just get like, oh my gosh, this is really getting to be a lot. And I want to take out a mortgage. I'd like to take out a business loan. Like, I'm going to be adding debt. Mm-hmm. So within the first 1 to 2 years, it actually is advisable to look at the private banks that exist out there, like SoFi, or Earnest, or DR Bank, and you do what's called a basically refinance or reconsolidate. You take your loans off the federal rolls, move it to a private bank who will actually amortize this over 20 years. So the visual that I would give your listeners is, imagine a piece of taffy, you stretch it out, 10 inches. It's gonna be pretty thick. We'll stretch it out now 20 inches, and it's gonna be a much longer, thinner piece. If I take my $500,000 student loan, take it to a private bank and refinance it over 20 years, you won't take 20 years to pay off your loans. You guys all do really well financially, income-wise. But you want your mandatory minimum payment to be artificially really low. What that does is two things. It allows you to make extra payments that are principal only. Those are powerful payments to make. So all of a sudden, I can shrink this thing down to 8 years, 9 years, 10 years, whichever, but I'm making principal only. So it's just really chopping that loan down. So that's the first advantage. The second advantage is when you go to a bank and you apply for a mortgage or a business loan, they're going to look at something called your debt to income ratio. They're going to say, all right, well, if you're bringing home $10,000 a month and four of it is going to debt, and now we're going to add another debt, I don't know that we have room for you, so we can't give it to you. If I recast that student loan and stretch it out 20 years, now all of a sudden my mandatory payment, even if I'm making $4,000 payments, I'm only required to make 1,700 or 2 grand, much more palatable. So it's not that you're saying I'm going to take 20 years to pay off my loans. That's what most doctors are like, oh my gosh, now I'm going to have this thing for 20 years. No, just give yourself some breathing room, because those first just 36 to 48 months, you learn so much in that, post training. Your speed gets up, your reputation gets up, and so does your income. Well, let's kind of press down these loans to give you a little breathing room to build cash, get started on investing. And then usually about 7, 8, 9 years out is when most of your peers start to get aggressive on loans, but not until then.
So in this time when like suppose you just have a job, you have this, you've refinanced, things are looking good. And maybe you get married, maybe you want to buy a house, maybe you want to start a family. How can you try something on, so to speak? Like maybe trying on a, what does a mortgage feel like? What does a car payment feel like? How would you go about that so you know that you're not going to be stretched too thin, in addition to your, student loan payments?
A great question. I love it. Because most people just, they really don't think about this. So mortgages are kind of natural, right? So again, for kind of another good rule of thumb, when you're looking at buying a house as an example, that's the next big, beyond student debt. Mortgages talk about an emotional purchase, right? That's super fun. They've got HDTV on 24/7. They're looking at, properties online. Stay within 2 to 2.5 times your household gross income, and you won't be house poor. Stay within 2 to 2.5 times, and you won't be house poor. So, for example, if someone's making $200,000 and they want to buy a $400,000 home, go for it. If they want to buy a $500,000 home, you absolutely can't go for it. But if you buy 550 or 600,
You
you're
start feeling that.
disproportionately spending too much. Okay. So just stay within that 2 to 2.5 times. You won't be house poor. But to your question earlier about how do I really actually know? How do we put this from concept to how do I feel it? Well, in that money market, a great practice is to open up what we call just the house account, meaning you go into your money market, create another savings account, call it your house account. And if you decide or determine, hey, all right, this is the mortgage, what it's going to be, there's great calculators online, mortgagecalculator.com. It's a free website, it's awesome. But you can type in $500,000 mortgage or 400,000 or whatever it is, and it'll spit out what the mortgage payment would be over 30 years with taxes and insurance. And so then whatever your rent is today, so let's say it's 2,500, but a mortgage is going to be 3,500. Well, you pay your rent every month and then take the difference, in this case it would be an extra 1,000, and drive that into your savings, your house account. So again, two things happen. One, you get comfortable with the budget. Because all too often people are like, we bought a house, we're super excited, but our first mortgage payment's due, we're really nervous. And you're like, okay, have you not tried this on before? You haven't given this a dry run? So it's important to kind of sense of, even though it's 2 times income and theoretically, I just don't know that I want to spend that much on a mortgage. So maybe I'm looking in the wrong space, or maybe we should hang tight a little bit longer. So it really really pressure tests your cash flow. Mm-hmm. It really pressure tests your cash flow. No one's going to budget their way into like a house purchase. You have to actually act as if you bought the house yesterday. It's a great question. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really good advice. I want to switch gears a little bit and kind of speak from my personal journey. There's a lot of different insurance policies that you get bombarded with as a practitioner. Like, you've got short-term disability, long-term disability, you've got your malpractice. If you have a spouse, you've got life insurance. Can you kind of give us a little synopsis on how we should be thinking about these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think insurances, they are important, but they often come with like a conversation with an insurance agent who somehow got your cell phone and is bothering you on the weekends. And you're like, come on. And it's a premium and it's all this stuff. But if you think about insurances, insurances really are kind of like the spine of a financial plan. And what I mean by that is you're going to be building wealth and, you know, your practice. But insurances is if anything comes flying in that you couldn't anticipate, insurances kind of reject that. They push that risk to deeper pockets. So, for example, you mentioned disability insurance. What you want to be protecting, obviously, is your income, number one, first and foremost, which is why most of the attendings, everyone's like, you got to do this, you got to get disability insurance, and a lot of doctors are like, I guess, but what? Well, here's why you do it. The reason you do it is because in the world of investing, diversification matters, right? You can appreciate that. But everything you've done up to this point, from dental school, some of you residency, it all hinges on your ability to get to the clinic and see patients. Mm-hmm. And if as long as you can do that, you'll get paid, you'll be able to pay off your debt, build wealth, acquire new debt by way of a mortgage, upgrade your cars, travel, etc. All of that hinges on one thing: your ability to practice. So once you kind of start to realize that, you're like, oh, geez, okay, so maybe it makes sense for me to protect my income. And that is with long-term disability income protection is the long form, or just long-term disability insurance is as it's referred to. No insurance company will protect 100% of your income, because they want you to have some incentive, I guess. This is their rationale, not mine, to go find a way to get back to work. Mm-hmm. And specifically, what you're looking for is occupation specific. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an orthodontist and I can't practice as an orthodontist, I'm going to receive a benefit. Mm-hmm. And it's long-term. So after 90 days, it's on that 91st day that you're going to start to receive a benefit. And then until you're healed or until you're 65 or 67, whichever comes first. Even if you can teach, because see, there are disability plans out there that say, yeah, if you're disabled, we'll cover you. Mm-hmm. People are like, all right, great, let's get it. Like Aflac, that kind of stuff. But language matters, and these contracts are written by lawyers. If it just says, if you can't work, we're going to cover you, well, that can mean anything. If you can't mm-hmm. answer emails at a desk, stand at Walmart and welcome people, like, not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what you trained for. Mm-hmm. There could be, in fact, I know of an attending that mm-hmm. is collecting disability. You wouldn't know it, but he was practicing and had an issue with his neck and his shoulder where he mm-hmm. couldn't turn certain ways, can no longer practice, but he's teaching and he's making a six-figure salary teaching. Mm-hmm. He can teach dentistry, but he can't be a clinician full-time in his practice. So he's receiving a disability benefit, even though he's still in the field of dentistry, just teaching it. That's powerful. Yeah. That is powerful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So protecting your income is one, of course, malpractice. So these are the kind of the core insurances. Got to protect your license. That's malpractice. Mm-hmm. You have to protect your income. Obviously the roof over your head, either that's renter's insurance or homeowner's insurance. And of course, car insurance, which outside of being in the clinic, that's why you have malpractice insurance. Mm-hmm. Once you leave, your biggest liability is driving around and tired and rear-ending somebody and checking text messages, even though we're not supposed to do that. And so one insurance that often gets overlooked, but it's tied to your home and auto or renters and auto insurance, is something called umbrella insurance. And this is kind of your first foray into asset protection. Mm-hmm. Once you start making a good living, the next thing you want to protect is your assets. Like, well, I don't want to get sued and outside. You know, I've got malpractice inside the clinic, but what if I'm outside?
Yeah.
Someone sees you in scrubs, they have no idea. They just see that as a walking dollar sign of like, this might be my ticket out of my miserable job.
Yeah.
So if I get rear-ended, I'm going to now sue. I have migraines. I can't work. I mean, I've seen it all. I've seen all kinds of scenarios play out. Umbrella is very inexpensive. You can get $1-3 million a year, and the premiums are like $500 a year, not a month, a year. Very inexpensive. And what that does is, if I, a real example, there was a doctor client of mine who was driving after a long week, long days, procedures. He's driving home. It's 4 o'clock. He's in the neighborhood. And he gets a text message. He looks down for 2 seconds. He's trailing a school bus that had stopped, and he rear-ended it. Fortunately, the school bus was empty, but the bus driver suddenly had migraines, headaches, couldn't focus, didn't want to drive the bus. And all of a sudden, he was sued. So they went to the bus company, and the bus company said, well, it's a doctor. We looked up your information, so they're going to sue him. Our client had umbrella coverage. So the bus company, or this driver, they have to fight through the insurance company's 25 paid retained attorneys that'll say, we're going to drag this through court for 2 years. Do you really have migraines? So now all of a sudden, this lawyer has to explain to their plaintiff, you know, we don't know if they have student loans. We don't know what their deal is. And I have to charge you by the hour. So we could be in court for 2 years. This isn't worth it. Go away. That's why umbrella is so inexpensive. The counter argument is, aren't I just throwing chum in the water? So there, people are going to sue me because I have this umbrella. No chance. If something's egregious, I had a client whose son ran a yellow light, quote unquote, and did kill, you know, T-boned and killed a father of two kids who did not have life insurance. But now all of a sudden our client was the life insurance policy for that family. Tragic. I mean, just tragedy. But the umbrella paid out. The attorney, of course, got their cut, but the umbrella paid out. And so now it a tragedy for sure, but it didn't get compounded because they weren't digging into their assets. He would have absolutely had to drain his savings, and he would want to. I'll drain my savings, whatever I have to do. My son ran the yellow light. I'll protect, take care of this family, but didn't have to. They received multiples of millions, which was way more than any non-life insurance that they didn't have. So it solved for it. Everyone's life has changed forever, but it's just good practice that once you're done training to pick up something very inexpensive like umbrella coverage. So that's your asset protection for it.
Wow.
And then lastly, I would say life insurance. Don't ignore it. I know it's not for you. I mean, it only happens or cashes in when you die.
Yeah. And the younger you are when you get it, the cheaper it is.
Yeah.
The cheaper it is. Yeah.
So it's disability, right?
So it's disability. Yeah. Every year that we get older, insurance gets more expensive. So it was cheaper for everybody last year, unless you hadn't put it in place yet. Mm-hmm. Life insurance, if you think about life insurance, and this is where insurance agents kind of muddy the waters, because like, well, you can invest in it, you can own it or rent it. Like, it gets all kind of muddy. But here's just something that I would share with your audience, which is this. Life insurance is a responsibility insurance. If someone's depending on you, life insurance makes sense. It could be a bank. I mean, someone might be single and they're like, nobody's really dependent on me, but I'm going to go to a bank tomorrow and take out a bank loan. The first requirement on a loan for a bank is life insurance. And the bank is going to be listed as the beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be listed. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good to know. I mean, I didn't know that.
And I would like to close out this insurance section by alerting everyone that already has insurance, whether it's homeowners or renters or life or whatever, to re-examine those policies, because the economic landscape, especially within the last 5 years, has really changed. And speaking from personal experience, I was underinsured in a homeowner complete loss situation. And thank goodness I had umbrella. And, you know, I probably know more than the average person about insurance. But with everything that we've been through lately with inflation and building cost rise, and especially the state of Texas, because shockingly, everyone wants to move here. All of our supplies, like wood and everything, have just skyrocketed in pricing. And so if you have a homeowner's insurance that you got when you bought your house 10 years ago, those limits are out of date. If you lost your house, you could not rebuild it, I'm gonna guess, for what you are insured for currently. So I highly, highly recommend a re-examination of all of your policy limits at this time.
Sarah,
Consider
I
your
couldn't agree
formal
more.
notice.
Yeah, truly. I mean, it's good practice. Most people just want to file it away and be done with it because it's a dry topic. I get it. It's dry, but it's when you need it is when all that's not the time to be reviewing it. So, Sarah, to your point, it takes about 3 or 4 years and you're out of alignment. Like a chiropractic visit. I'm not advocating going to a chiropractor, they're great, but it's you do need to reevaluate, pull them out of the files and reevaluate as it matches up to your current situation or where you're headed in the next couple of years and make the adjustments, and you will be glad you did. Nobody didn't retire because they paid premiums on insurances. But
That's true.
GoFundMe is full of examples of people who did not have insurance and now it's a virtual,
You are correct.
passport. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So maybe this is premature and maybe it's not. I guess that's what I'll let you answer. How soon into your career should you start thinking about retirement? Like you've finally seen a check and now you're starting to plan your exit out of the profession. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question because you think, boy, I'm already thinking about stopping or quitting or retiring. It's interesting. It's hard to stay motivated on retirement when you're still in the shadows of a student loan, and then if you take out a mortgage, there's another half. You could be several millions in debt. It's not unusual. There's a an orthodontist I work with who said, "Hey, good news." Because he bought a practice and has a mortgage and still has some residual student loans. He said, "Good news, I finally am underneath $6 million of debt." Just a huge number. So I mean, I've seen it all. I've seen it all. But here's the motivation that I would say you can turn into inspiration, because motivation is too fleeting, right? You're like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start saving. Automate your savings. It'll take care of everything. I mean, truly automate your savings. In terms of a strategy, it should be automated. But here's what I think the mindset should be. Don't think about just stopping or quitting, although there's some days that you might feel that way. But get in the mindset of I'm saving because I want to get to a space where I'm practicing because I want to. It's incredibly powerful. If you can imagine showing up to the clinic tomorrow and you're there because you're like, no, I mean, I could retire. I could have retired on Monday. But I genuinely just like to
Like being
practice. I want to
here.
help the, yeah, exactly. That is powerful. And that formula I shared at the top, that 15% of your gross, those first couple of years, if you're young, even if you're 40 and you're like, oh my gosh, do I even have a shot at retirement? It takes 20 years. Start saving 15% of your gross income for 20 years. And in 20 years, you can retire or you can work because you want to. So it's that savings cadence that will morph its way into retirement, but be patient. It is a marathon, but it's going to go fast.
But it
First
gives you
couple of
so much
years,
freedom, it sounds like.
1,000%. 1,000%. Yeah.
So I want to
Did that
transition.
answer the question? Did I answer
I think
that?
so. I just have this pie chart floating in my head, 15% at the beginning for emergency fund, and then that transfers to high yield debt, and then that transfers to scheduled debt, and then 30% for a mortgage at the most. And now we're talking. So we're up to 45, like
What's left?
what's left in that pie chart?
Well, the 15%, to clarify, Sarah, is if I want to be aggressive on debt, I tell people you can be aggressive on debt, but time does matter. So here's another thing that I think is really worth exploring for a minute. If somebody says, I'm highly motivated, I'm going to pay on all my debt in the first couple of years, I'm like, okay, that could work, but it also may not. That's a hope plan versus that 15% of my gross goes to high interest debt, that 8% or greater. But once I've eliminated that 15% needs to be set aside or invested for my future. I can still be aggressive on debt. I just can't take it out of that sacred 15% of my gross income. Yeah. That needs to be invested and set
That's
aside
a magic number.
For my future. Yeah, yes. It is. And time matters. I mean, there's examples that I share with, if I do a speaking engagement, I have a visual, but I could paint it in 30 seconds or less. The emotionally appealing scenario is the doctor that pays down all their debt in the first 5-6 years and then starts saving, compared to the doctor who services their debt. Maybe they make extra payments, but they don't violate that 15%. They've built their cash. They got rid of their high interest, but now they start investing for themselves. So at the end of their first decade of working, the doctor who started saving earlier, compounding interest works in the long term. Mm-hmm. So it can be literally a difference of millions of dollars, because the challenge that the doctor is, or the assumption that the doctor is accepting when they say, I'm going to pay down all my debt first, let's just get rid of it, I'm going to feel great, have a debt elimination party, and then I'm going to start investing. The assumption is you will be able to save uninterrupted for the next 20 years. That's the assumption. That's a big assumption. That's a big assumption. You switch practices, there's a disruption of income. People go through divorces, big disruption of income. Kids go off to college, disruption of income. It just can happen. So you can't assume that if I just lean in and get rid of all my debt, our parents are probably thrilled because they're kind of feeling like, well, I'm glad that's off your shoulders. That's how parents feel about it. But you have to manage your debt. And yeah. So that retirement, whatever you do early, your future success on investing actually has more to do with how long have you been investing, not what. I mean, what's important, yeah. But
debt's not always the bad guy.
Right.
Yeah. And right. That's a hard pill to swallow sometimes.
Hard one. Mm-hmm.
You got it. I want to talk a little bit about the seasoned dentist. We talked a lot about the new dentist. When you're kind of making that career transition from, you know, associate to maybe practice owner, what financial markers are we looking at just in general to make sure we're ready to take that on?
Yeah, in terms of like, now I'm going to own this practice, I'm going to
yes.
run it. This
yeah, do I have the money to own? How am I going to pay myself? You know, yeah. Sometimes it, especially if we're building from scratch, you know, your income isn't necessarily guaranteed there.
Right, right. So in that case, you do want to, when you start to kind of position yourself to run the show, now I'm going to be the practice owner, which is, you know, anybody can appreciate that is flexing different muscles. You know, you are taught and built to be a practitioner, clinician, and then running a practice and managing conflict resolution and people not sure.
Yeah.
It's a whole different, that's a different animal. But at a high level, I would tell you a doctor should have a year's worth of cash, because once you launch this practice, you're going to want to reinvest in the practice, drive revenue back in to really get this off the ground, versus I'm going to take a bunch off this practice and not be mindful of, I got to reinvest. I have to reinvest. So just good business 101, put yourself in a position, you're going to take a paycheck, but be in a position where you could literally not take one for the first full year. You're going to have revenue, but that is, you can think differently when you're sitting on cash. So I would push that 6-month emergency reserve probably closer to 10, if not to a year. And then, because what happens is when you go to a bank and you take out a loan, most people think, do I have to make a down payment? Well, not if you're taking a loan for a practice, you actually don't need to make a down payment. But one of the qualifications is, how much cash are you sitting on? And I know Bank of America, if somebody's in their first 3 years and you want to take out a practice loan to buy a practice, start a practice, if you're in the first 36 months, they make you sign or show them that you've signed a contract to work at a competing office in your first 2 years, like twice a week or something. They want to know, can you satisfy this loan? Because this practice is brand new. But if you tell a banker, I have a whole year's worth of living expense, I mean, we're good. I'll get you taken care of. That to me is probably chief among markers for someone to be ready.
And how do you kind of stagger maybe buying a practice, buying a house? What should you do first?
Yeah. Always be communicating with your banker. You know, if you're talking to a banker saying, hey, I'm looking at taking out this bank loan for a practice versus a mortgage. If it's all in the same year, buy the practice first.
Okay.
Buy the practice first. The reason is because a practice is revenue generating. A mortgage is, it feels good, it's stability, but it's a drain. And so if
Yeah.
I just bought a home and then I go and try to take out a practice loan in the next 6 to 9 months, it's going to be very difficult for me to get that loan, if at all, because they're going to say, geez, you just took out this mortgage. Now you're going to try to do a practice. If I have a practice and then I go and take out a mortgage, they're going to be like, okay, good. So you have this practice generating your revenue. Got it. Yep, good. And that's your litmus test right there. As much as people say, well, my house is an investment, and it isn't actually. It's an asset, but it's
Yes.
not an investment. Investment we could sell today and do something different on Friday. So that's how you would stagger it. Practice loan first. If it's within a year and you just bought a home, but it's been a year, you'll be fine. 18 months is even better, but it really should be that, because otherwise you just aren't going to get good rates. They'll limit how much you can borrow. It's a little bit of a
A
dance
dance.
until
Yep.
enough time has gone by. Yeah.
Yeah. Did those the investment strategies and retirement strategies we talked about for a newer dentist, does that change now with practice ownership or even just later in your into your career?
Yeah. So for your listeners who have a practice, when they're thinking about retirement, you know, again, I'll restate this, because I think this is worth restating. Money, anytime you're setting a dollar aside for anything relating to investing, you first have to answer the question, when do you need this money? Like, when might I need it? If I'm setting money aside and I'm saying, I don't need this until I'm 60 or later, like this is for, see you a decade down the road. Well, then that would be an appropriate inside a retirement vehicle, like a 401k, a simple, a SEP, Roth, et cetera. All those types of vehicles, very clear. You can't touch it till you're 60. And if you do, 10% penalty plus taxes, it's very punitive.
Yeah.
So if I'm setting money aside, most people think, well, I have to max those vehicles out. My CPA is telling me I got to max out this retirement plan. Well, the problem with that is if you drain your cash disproportionately just to reduce some of your tax bills, you could put yourself back into debt. So there's a careful balance. So time matters. So there's traditional retirement plans, and then there's things called brokerage accounts, which is just a savings account, but gives you full access to the market by way of mutual funds. Stocks, of course, too. Stocks is just professional financial gambling. So unless you're having lunch with the CEO, I would say just stick with mutual funds, because it's immediately diversified. But mutual funds, which also will find themselves in retirement plans, traditional retirement plans, a brokerage account is spectacular, because it's essentially your money market on steroids, but you have full access to it. So I can fill that thing up and grow it for my future. But if I need some money next Tuesday, I can pull it back. I can
Yeah.
pull it back. Now, if I'm moving money into the brokerage, the mentality or the commitment should be, I don't need this for at least 3 years. Because the reality is the stock market is volatile and it's up and down and sideways. It's very sawtooth in the short term. But as it gets longer, you know, more time, it will start to behave and look a little more appropriate. So a brokerage account, if I'm putting money there, I'm saying, I want this for retirement, but I don't know, 3 or 4 years from now, five, I might need some. Brokerage. Brokerage accounts can be huge. If you've got 3, 4, 5 years worth of living expenses in a brokerage account, so you might have 150, 250, 300, th then you can now say, all right, now I'm going to shift gears and start emphasizing some of these more traditional but heavily locked down retirement plans, because I'd have to burn through, you know, all my cash plus my brokerage. I'm going to be fine. As opposed to, I'm too anemic in the brokerage. I'm going to have to tap these traditional 401ks or SEP IRAs.
Yeah.
The IRS, they do a report every August. There'll be one coming out soon. Last year, they collected $10 million in fees, just penalties, from people tapping their 401ks or 403b if they're at a
Wow.
hospital prematurely. Because you, and they looked at it in age graphs from age 20 to 30, 31 to 40, 41 to 50. And the worst culprit, most people would think, it's got to be 21 to 30. They're in their 20s. I invested, I needed the money back. Actually, the worst culprits was 41 to 50. 41 to 50.
Yeah.
Because they've been told and rightfully said, okay, I'm going to drive money into this traditional retirement plan. And then all of a sudden, one of their kids is getting married or they just need cash. They need to help out a parent. And they're like, you know, I have no money anywhere. I guess I got to tap into this and just pay the penalty. And it's just, it's unfortunate. The story actually isn't how bad these people are managing their dollars. They just misallocated. They weren't mindful of, I might need this money sooner. And I know that there's tax benefits inside these retirement plans, but it's not all about tax. But I know people that'll spend $100 just to save 30 on taxes. Come on. So a brokerage account is a beautiful vehicle to really kind of build out and put you in a position to then say, this money I know I don't need for the next decade.
On the flip side of, I guess, well, not the flip side, but the natural progression of owning a practice is bringing on an associate. What does the financial situation need to look like for the practice, even for yourself? Like sometimes I see owners practicing fewer days and then they're, you know, they have the associate covering the rest of the days in the practice. Is there anything that we're looking at to make sure that we have enough to, you know, keep the lights on and give everyone a check to take home, you know, at the end of the day?
Yeah. I mean, it's good. Because once you bring on an associate, someone begins their succession plan.
Mm-hmm.
Which is spectacular. I see that a succession plan where they bring in associate, groom, and continue to market. And so there's mm-hmm. actually one and a half doctors now, or two, however they want to market it. But to your point, what if someone's doing it to kind of take a step back a little bit, mm-hmm. and then this young associate's going to be there to buy the practice and
take
run
it
with
over
it.
Later. Yeah,
you got it. It's probably a good idea to run a financial plan, like a much more thorough, hey, if I'm not going to be saving as much, can I still hit my mark? Because the reality is they will be able to sell their practice. Mm-hmm. And so there is going to be some inflow there. So that has to be kind of factored in, as opposed to I may not be able to pay my bills. But once you start, there's not necessarily a marker, but there's going to be a real, should be temporary impact, unless someone's intentionally going part-time. I would say when you're within a year of saying, I'm going to start looking for an associate, that's a good idea to just run a full-blown financial plan to say, okay, if I sell this practice in 10 years, if things go well, if I start working part-time, even if I'm still saving 15%, it's not the same volume as it was before.
Right.
Can I maybe even extend my life, you know, professional life, if I do it this way? There's a lot of benefits to that, but it's good to understand what is the trajectory, how does the trajectory change, and am I comfortable with that?
And when we're like kind of reevaluating these financial plans, are we also reevaluating like our insurance needs and maybe getting that umbrella coverage, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you got everything. It should be done holistically. And so I always tell people, you know, look for an advisor that is independent, but that handles everything. Hold it, not just an advisor that manages money for a 1% management fee. It should be a holistic plan, meaning we got to look at everything. We got to do the full x-ray. I want to make sure we're looking at everything, because are your insurances in alignment? Is there a long-term care need that we need to start factoring in the next 3 or 4 years? Even the estate plan. Right. Mm-hmm. Because if I have a practice that I'm going to sell, but now I have grown children that are getting married, well, hold on a second. I got to think about how do I want these dollars to flow downstream? So there's a lot to it that needs to be kind of worked
through.
It
could be its own
episode. Not solved. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not that they have to solve it, but it is kind of, it takes a year, because it isn't just in a half an hour, like, okay, good. I'm good. I'm going to hire somebody. But some people, it's not that you need to run a full financial plan to decide if you're hiring an associate. The question would be, if you're looking to take a step back permanently, let's evaluate the whole plan, how we look at it. Mm-hmm. If someone's saying, I'm going to bring somebody on, I know I'm going to take a little bit of a pay cut, but we have this marketing campaign I've been putting back into the practice, then, okay, that's a different animal. That's just, hey, temporarily, we may have to ease off on our savings. But again, it goes back to what I was sharing earlier. If somebody is just spending their first 4 or 5 years paying down all their debt, while that's not wrong, the question really should be, was it optimal? Because the doctor who's 45, 47, who says, I want to work another 10 years, but I'm going to take another, a year or a year and a half as I develop this associate. I got to make sure it works. We're going to put back into the practice marketing, upgrade to the equipment, whatever. But they have all these savings that are just going to be compounding. They can afford to do that. But the 47 or 48-year-old doctor is like, listen, I'm a little behind. I mean, I paid off my debt a long time ago, but my 65-year-old self is starting to knock on the door saying, hey, where's the cash? How are we going to live off of this?
For a dentist, it seems like we've got a lot of people that we trust implicitly in helping us, run the practice, run our financial lives. What kind of professionals do you feel like dentists should have on their financial team?
Yeah, on the financial team, a good CPA or a CPA firm, but a CPA. Because a CPA's job is to look back, like, okay, here's all the revenue you created, how you pay yourself, the type of retirement plan that the practice implements. That's all going to have a tax implication. So a good CPA to help with taxes, a good lawyer, and sometimes you might have two lawyers, like an estate planning attorney that you meet with once every 5 years. I mean, the estate rules change. So trusts and wills and all that stuff, for what it's worth. A young couple should have like a power of attorney. There's your estate plan. And then it builds out when you have kids. You need to have guardianship and you put together a simple will and then you have testamentary trust. So it kind of lays down. But a good estate planning attorney that you need to visit once every 5 years. And also an attorney that will set up or incorporate you. Sometimes CPAs can do that, but I want an attorney to draft it only because from a legal perspective, if somebody tries to sue me, a CPA can't defend it. I need my lawyer to do it. Right? So you're going to have a good lawyer for legal, whether it's protecting yourself, the practice by way of incorporations and estate. And then you have a CPA for taxes. And a financial planner looks forward that says, okay, so if this is what we're trying to get accomplished, let's make sure we have the appropriate insurances in place to protect this plan, the right investments to accelerate the plan. And they work in concert with the lawyers and the CPA. That all work kind of, and you're at the center saying, here's what I want to see happen. How do we do this legally and from an accounting perspective and a financial perspective? Those three are going to be critical.
Perfect. Sarah, do you have a game you want to play with
Davin, we have this section at the end of every podcast that we call What the Suck. And that just might be, it's a play on dental suction, but since you are not a dentist, and you don't play one on TV either,
All right, yeah. I
I
had a good
think,
night's sleep, though. Is
oh well, there you
that
go.
Yeah.
I think the question evolves for you. What do you view from like the financial A to Z? You're out of dental school all the way till, I guess, death. What is the biggest hurdle for someone to overcome? Or what's the most trying period, and how do you overcome it? Some big pointers there that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think because you go from I like to play on the words. It's as you evolve, one suck kind of hands off to the next suck.
There you go.
So
Run with
things to
it,
kind
run
of,
with it.
So things to be like when you for the probably the biggest mental gymnastics that a young doctor has to wrestle with is you will probably be keeping your debt around longer. If financial independence is important, which it is, right? That kind of goes without saying. But that drive is very real. It's visceral. People lose sleep. I've seen people lose relationships because of the mismanagement of debt. That's why having a debt plan using the 8% rule, saving 15%, if you stay consistent, it will work. Consistency matters, but it's just, you've got patience, and all of a sudden you get a lawsuit, and you're like, what? I mean, what am I? Why did I do that? Well, it is worth it. Your field, you guys do tremendously well. Your income is like the tide, it just keeps coming in. But once you kind of get a handle on your debt, the different pressures of you'll compare yourself, which is also death. Like, don't avoid that at all costs, trying to compare yourself to somebody else who didn't have student loans, went through the military or whatever. But you're going to have pressures of family, like balancing out a professional life that's very demanding. There's a reason why you guys work 4 days or less if you can. It's incredibly physically demanding, emotionally, intellectually. It's in, people underestimate that if they're not in that field. And not only just the legal pressure. And then just as our families get older, kids can, you know, I talk to doctors all the time. They're like, man, I've got, you know, teenagers who are going through it. And then I've got a practice. My hygienist just quit. And the next order of inventory didn't show up. And we're behind on, you know, I've seen it all. And those are very real pressures. So if you have your, if you're sitting on good cash, you've got a consistent savings path, you can at least quiet the noise to say, okay, no matter what happens tomorrow, I know I can afford it. And that just getting your, taking the time to set these kind of these ground rules for yourself, can dramatically change how you think through some of these challenges. Parents getting older. I mean, the baby boomer, that the average baby boomer, of which there's like 10,000 of them turning the age of 65 for, I think, the next 2 years. They've been doing it for the past 8. There's still 2 more years. There's literally 10,000 people every day turning 65. And the average baby boomer has saved $150,000. That's it. Like, Social Security is their plan. The reality is, if you're a doctor, so many of your listeners are like the first doctor in the family or the only, you become the financial kind of spoke. Like, can you help? Can you give it? Setting boundaries, super difficult. That is really, again, a whole nother podcast. That is, it's a, that's incredibly important because they see scrubs again. They think you can help me out. You can, that is tough. Like, that's really difficult. Money, it's not the reason for what you do. Money just is the vehicle so that you can do stuff. But people mismanage it. They cope with stuff by spending and consumption. And, but that would be, recognize that as you do better, there's going to be new challenges you can't see. And consistency is how you're going to navigate your way through it. But it's, you have to be grounded. You've got to set boundaries for yourself, like all, take care of yourself, eat well, sleep well, like all that good stuff.
Yes. And lastly, we like to leave the listening audience with a tangible. So do you recommend a specific book, a specific CE course, any person, anything that you can leave the audience with, as in go do this and drink the Kool-Aid?
Yeah, that's a great, Sarah, I would, there's two books that I would tell at any stage of life where anybody is that I would tell is a great read, because it isn't just about the mechanics of a mutual fund, which nobody, everyone's bored by this. I love it. I mean, show me that textbook. I'm diving in. But there's a really, really good book called The Psychology of Money, written by Morgan Housel. It's called The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. On the front cover, there's like a brain, these dollar signs that are kind of framed into a brain. That's a really good book. And then the next one that I would say to read is Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth, written by Nick Murray, who's this Brooklyn, he's been an advisor since the 70s. He never writes for the public. He only writes for like advisor to advisor. He's a practitioner, always has been. He's seen it all, lived it all, but he did write this book called Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth. And it's a really, really good read. I've often, if I've got copies of it, I'll give it out to clients. It's those two reads to me. That's your, the next 2 weeks, you won't be able to put them down. They're so good.
Wow. Well, I'm going to go out and buy that.
I wish I got royalties. So I don't get any royalties from these.
Soon.
Neither do we. Don't worry.
Well, thank you so much, Devin, for coming on our podcast.
Absolutely.
Let you go. Where can our listeners find you if they would like to connect with you off pod?
Love it. Yeah. Thank you. My email, of course, they can always just drop me an email, davin.bell@northstar.com. So it's davin.bell. And then at northstar.com. www.mortgagefinancial.com. Kind of a long email. But yeah, that's probably the best way. Our firm website is just Northstar Financial. But my name, email, by all means, drop me a note. Even if you just want to ask a question, and just understand our service. I don't charge by the minute or by the hour. So if somebody wanted to give me a call and just say, here's kind of what I'm wrestling with, maybe even have an advisor. But I've got some questions. I'd welcome it.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you again. That's it for today's episode. Huge thanks to Davin Bell for breaking down the emotional and practical aspects of financial planning. Whether you're saving, paying down debt, or just trying to figure out where to begin, remember, consistency is key and your career is a long game. Catch you in the next episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review.